On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Altney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You know, it's always interesting when you see somebody, an actor, with a really expressive face. So generally, that's the kind of thing we see in comedy, turn to drama. And my guest, Olivia Wilde, an actress with a really expressive face, has turned to drama again. She was last here with the drama. She's here with her new drama, Meadowland. First of all, thanks so much for coming back.
Thank you for having me back.
And first of all, tell the audience what the film's about. It's directed by its cinematographer, Reed Morano.
Yes.
And that's, I can sort of see that in the filmmaking.
Sure, yes. Reed Morano is a very experienced DP. She shot Skeleton Twins, Kill Your Darlings, Frozen River, Little Birds. She's phenomenal. And this is her first gig as a director. And she shot the movie, operated the camera, and was the DP and directed, which was an incredible experience for us, the actors, because it created this intimacy. The movie is about this couple, Luke Wilson and myself, whose child goes mysteriously missing. And rather than focusing on the investigation of that mystery, the movie cuts to a year later, where we see these two parents spinning out of control in very different ways. So it's more a psychological drama. It's more about that kind of unraveling than any sort of procedural.
We should say, too, that it's that their careers are both these kinds of self-inflicted torture. So she's a school teacher and he's a police officer.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Was that always in the script that that's what they did for a living? I mean, that for me, just to see that, that's the real shock of the movie, more so, in fact, than the crime being committed is what they're doing after that. Because I just thought, is she sitting in a PTA meeting or something?
Mm-hmm.
And she's there as a school teacher.
And in my mind, being a school teacher is really the only option for her. I don't think she enjoys it. I don't think she's a particularly good teacher. She doesn't have the energy to inspire these students. She's teaching them poetry that's perhaps way over their heads. She's distracted, understandably. This is not, you know, Dangerous Minds or Half Nelson. She's not changing their lives with inspiring, you know, stories. And they're not necessarily lifting her out of her rut. Although she sees in one of them a reflection of herself and it ends up saving her life. But yeah, I agree. The decision to be among children would be torture. And for Luke Wilson's character, Phil, to be a cop, how maddening, how torturous. And I think he handled that so beautifully, just to see a powerless police officer. There's something so heartbreaking about this masculinity that is strangled.
Because I guess I wonder if that was one of the things that when you saw the script made you want to do it, just the idea of playing this thing that meant the kids are inescapable and inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
if that was one of the things that made you want to do this.
I wanted to do this because she was so complex and flawed and mysterious to me. This character, Sarah, is pretty rough around the edges. Her response to grief is in that kind of dangerous phase when people lose the instinct for self-preservation. And that's when people are unpredictable. And I found her to be in this sort of terrifying place where she's not trying to fit into society. Society has nothing left for her. There's no place for her within it because she doesn't understand how one could continue when their heart has been ripped from their chest. There's no closure for her, and she's not seeking closure because that would mean defeat. But she is so angry, and it's kept her in this kind of haze where I found her to be just kind of electrifying but very scary to herself and to others. And she's kind of destroying everything in her path. But, you know, they say that numbness is the most dangerous
thing to experience.
Yeah, numbness is the most dangerous part of depression. If someone is numb, that's when you worry about them. If you feel numb, that's when you really need help. And I think that's what Sarah is feeling. She's stuck in this fog, and that's what I wanted to kind of cut through and explore. And wow, I mean, putting on her skin every day was intense because I retreated into that fog with her.
Yeah? Because I just thought her impatience becomes this form of cruelty.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
And that was just that she seems to be in a hurry to make things happen, but I don't know why she's in this kind of weird hurry. It's almost like she's trying to push herself past feeling like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think she's rejecting the idea of the process of grief and closure and that there is somehow a path that has been created by other people experiencing the same thing, because she can't acknowledge that anyone else has ever felt this feeling or that there is an inevitability to it, that her child might be gone forever. She has completely convinced herself of this story that he was picked up by another family and that he's living a happy life. And there's so much guilt involved in that that she can't possibly see it any other way. But yeah, I think that sort of that impatience is part of a desire to move so fast that you don't have to acknowledge what's happening. It's like keep your feet above the ground, keep running. And yet her partner, who is the only person who can truly understand her grief because he's lost the same child, is dealing at a completely different rhythm. He has slowed down. And so they can't possibly see eye to eye.
And I just want to ask you about that choice to play her, somebody who really doesn't seem to have much tolerance for anything that doesn't happen the way she wants it to happen. She's
yeah.
almost in this weird way retreated to becoming a kind of a spoiled child herself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that comes from her anger. I think it comes from her pain. And there's a frustration when you feel that amount of pain. I mean, we've all felt pain in different ways. I have never faced anything as difficult as this character. It definitely felt like a there but for the grace of God go I experience, you know.
Because you're a recent mom. So.
I'm a recent mom, and I had just had my son Otis when we started shooting because, you know, I produced the film and it took us 3 years to get the movie made. And once we were shooting, it's not like I could say, well, now I'd like to take some mommy time. So we're just going to push. It was like we are shooting this movie and we are so grateful to do so. And I really empathized so deeply with this character that I thought in anything she chooses to do, no matter how harsh it seems, I understand, and I would even do worse. There were times when the director, Reed Morano, is a mother as well. She has two young sons.
And that's her son at the beginning of the movie, isn't
that's
it?
Her son who plays the son who goes missing, which was a gift from her to me to say, I'm going to go there too. I'm going to put myself in this personally and emotionally so that you know you're not out there alone. And there were times when other people involved in the film would question a decision we made about Sarah, you know, taking harsh actions of one type or another. And we'd say, no, we would do far worse. I mean, once your mother wolf comes out, there's nothing you're not capable of. And that can be a very positive force, and that can be a very self-destructive force.
Well, but, you know, I was thinking about this, Olivia, because you and Lance were Drinking Buddies, which is another film about somebody in kind of a downward spiral.
Yeah, and, absolutely.
And I just wonder, because, again, you have such an expressive face. One of the more powerful scenes for me in this movie is that scene where she's brushing her teeth and her face is just slack.
Yeah.
When she's by herself.
Yeah.
And that's who she is when she's alone.
Yeah.
And I was really struck by you playing it that way in that particular moment where she's not even looking in the mirror. It's just...
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Going through this thing, it's like she's been programmed to go through her everyday duties, but she's just not in it. And that sense of disconnect,
mm-hmm.
What is it that attracts you to these characters who are just out of touch with the world?
I think there's something liberating in that to me. I think that I find it, I'm attracted to it because maybe I feel that I have to be in touch with the world too often. Maybe I feel that I'm sort of making myself presentable a lot of the time. Maybe I feel that I keep things under control and I keep a life together and keep it moving, and I'm someone who kind of has things under control. And so I find people, characters who have lost that instinct kind of liberating. It's so different from my life. But it's an instinct we all have. And I think that, you know, especially for female characters, there's something liberating about it because women are expected, I think, to keep it together. And I think audiences find it quite thrilling, including myself, to watch a female character unravel. You know, we see it throughout literature. It's fascinating to hear stories, read stories, watch stories about women unraveling because they are the mothers. They are the ones raising us, keeping us together. And if the mother is unraveled, you know, that's like the universe is out of order.
It's the treatment. My guest who seems to treat emotional freefall as a kind of dessert is Olivia Wilde, her newest film as actress and producer, is Meadowland. But as you're saying that, so much about women in film, for the most part, unfortunately, is about being presentational, about showing this face,
mm-hmm.
and or, you know, putting the comforting hand on the shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
And you played these, in both of these cases, because I watch Drinking Buddies again just to get ready for this, just watching as they don't know what to do with themselves physically anymore, just the way the posture changes. Like, I don't care if you're looking at me or not. Talk about doing that. I mean, just in both these cases, they're both, like, in neither case, it's like their bones have no tension in them anymore. It's just, I don't know what holds them up.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. I think, again, I find that so liberating because, you know, ever since I was a five-year-old girl in ballet class, I've been taught, you know, keep your shoulders back, keep your head up, walk with a purpose. I was raised by a very strong, smart mother, and she raised me to be a powerful woman. And though I appreciate that, and I think it's gotten me to places in life that I appreciate, I do find it so freeing to give all that up and to connect with characters who've lost the instinct for that. And I like to think that both of those characters in Drinking Buddies and Meadowland are people who are dealing with a certain amount of pain, and they have lost kind of an inner core of strength, of confidence. With Sarah in Meadowland, I imagined her as being hollowed out. That's what it felt to me. There's this feeling of intense shock and pain that is a kick in the stomach. It's a kick in the gut. And I imagined her never quite recovering from that kick in the gut. And so she was stuck in this hollowed out place. And rather than fill it with anything else, she's refusing. She is choosing to stay empty and hungry until she finds her son. And, you know, that was a different sort of emotional state than Kate and Drinking Buddies. But I do find it really freeing to not have to present some perception of a perfect woman. You know, I think on both those sets, I really appreciated that no one was saying to me, oh, it's a better position if you stand like this, or a better angle, or we're just going to get a better shot. It's more flattering. You know, there was no time wasted on that BS. It was all about what these characters were feeling and going through. And Reed Morano really helped me stay consistent with our physical choices for Sarah in Meadowland. You know, her walk, just her posture, even the way she breathed. You know, we worked on that together, and it was amazing because I could look at Reed and she would make a slight physical movement to remind me. Because as a producer in the film, you know, when we called cut, I had to walk around keeping everything in check as a producer. And I had fellow producers who were keeping everything together, but I still had a position that, you know, required that I stand up straight, make sure everything's under control.
Look like a boss.
Look like a boss, power posing. Fake it till you make it. And then go back into character. And so it was a really, you know, it was a kind of fascinating exercise.
Do you like doing that, having to sort of to assume this command and then to relinquish this command? I mean, did you like that moment of sort of shifting from one to the other?
I did. I did really like that. I liked that it forced me to become quite adept at that transition, and I got good at it. And, you know, the physical elements helped get me there emotionally. So once I would assume the kind of posture, I would understand where I was again. You know, that's a thing that I think actors find very helpful. I remember I made a movie called Butter that I love, that nobody's seen, but I just love this movie.
No better time to see Butter than now. You think the Republican the debates are funny.
Yeah, exactly.
Butter really is a version of that.
And in that movie, I played an exotic dancer with a heart of gold, of course, and not really a heart of gold. And she had
she thought she had a heart of gold.
Exactly.
She was always communicating what a good person she was in one way or another.
Right. And Diablo Cody wrote her memoir about being a stripper for a year. And I used that as kind of my Bible when I made that film. And there was something she wrote about that strippers, when they walk, they lead with their vagina. Like, that's the part of the body that they lead with. And when I was making Butter, I just kept thinking, well, here we go. I know what to lead with. And once I read that and once I kind of tried that with this character, I thought, anytime I don't know what to do, I put on these stripper heels and lead with the vagina, and then I know who I am. So that was for Butter. That was for Butter. And this
I can't wait to hear what you led with for Meadowland.
With Meadowland. Well, that was the thing. It's like, it's such a basic thing you learn, you know, in acting 101, to think about your body and movement, what part body part are you moving with, leading with, and it actually is instrumental in creating a performance that can be consistent on film. Because of the nature of filmmaking, you have to be able to snap into character very quickly. You're not on stage. There's no consistency. And so when you pull up to the side of the road and you have 2 minutes to get a shot and you have to get into character very quickly, it can be very helpful to have those physical cues, of course. So yeah, that was, I enjoy all that stuff.
We're going to take a break. My guest who's made me rethink dairy products is Olivia Wilde. Her new film is actress and producer's Metal Hand. It's a treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
KCRW's popular iPad Music Mine app is now available for the iPhone. From quick discovery to deep exploration, take KCRW music with you wherever you go. Download at kcrw.com/musicmine.
Welcome back. My guest who's clearly at home at KCRW is Olivia Wilde. Can I get you something else? Her new film as actress and producer is Metal Land. We were talking about that idea of physicality, and I guess I've often thought of you as being a physical actress, although, again, you have such an expressive face, the idea of making your body part of it, because so often people don't know how to move in movies.
Yeah, and often that can come from working in television. Television can develop really bad habits because more often than not so much anymore because there's such great television now, but for a long time.
But you were on a great show, which demanded that you probably almost speak another language.
Yes, exactly.
When you were doing House.
I speak medicine.
It's like, what are you?
Yeah, it's funny. I remember some of those terms. Still don't know what they mean. no, but I think a lot of times television is shot in close-ups. So you kind of lose the instinct for developing your physicality of the character. You become almost atrophied. And then you are working in film and they're staying in a wide shot. And the director will say, what are you doing? What are you doing with your hands? And, you know, that is something that I think inspired me to continue developing, you know, my physicality and to continue making those choices because I didn't want to fall into that rut. I was aware that was a possibility because I worked on television for years and now I'm doing it again. But the show I'm on now challenges me more than any film. So that's good.
Ahem, cough, cough. And what is that show that you are working on right now, Olivia?
It's called Vinyl.
And the producers are?
Martin Scorsese
and
Mick Jagger,
and
two newbies,
yeah.
And Terrence Winter, who
yeah.
is an incredible boss.
Who's only been doing stuff with HBO for like the last basically almost 20 years now.
Yeah, he's responsible for what we think of as HBO.
Yeah, and Boardwalk Empire and now this. And
yeah.
Is this another physical character? I mean, are you approaching her physically?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, now that's my favorite part of the process. And again, it helps me get into the emotional work. And especially when you're doing a period piece, Vinyl is about 1973 in New York, the music business, and thinking about how women carried themselves differently, how this woman I play.
You talk about being presentational. I mean, that's the way women, they were judged by the way they looked, mm-hmm. really, and then in fact thought to be only what they look like.
And it's interesting. This character I play went from being a factory girl to a Greenwich housewife and then kind of back into the New York downtown scene. So her physicality changes as her environment changes. So I love that work. And I think as a wannabe director, I find most exciting about, you know, helping actors find their characters. I have this fantasy about directing a movie and getting the actors to first choreograph a dance and express the entire script with no words and just define the physicality and find the movement. And then when on set shooting the film, to have to fight those instincts. You know, when you feel extreme anger, if you were allowed to express that physically, you might freak out physically. You might slam against the wall. You might, you know, jump up and down. And then to have to fight that instinct is an interesting challenge for me, to have to then be in a scene without moving, but knowing that you've figured out that that is your physical instinct, but in this moment you cannot do that. You can't pound your fists against the wall. You have to sit quietly because that's what's happening in this scene. I just think that would be kind of an interesting way to go about it. So I don't know what financier is going to give me the money to first have my actors for 6 weeks to choreograph a dance.
You just talked me into it. But let me ask you, though, are there filmmakers that you are attracted to as a viewer, as an audience, who do these kinds of things that you're talking about?
Well, I mean, there's like Mike Lee, who rehearses and improvises and discovers the characters with his actors.
And gives the actors basically, they're basically co-authors of the material.
Exactly. Right? And I had a taste of that with Joe Swanberg on Drinking Buddies, which was incredible to feel that collaboration. I felt that with Reed on this film. She and I had years.
How much time did you guys have to rehearse before you started shooting? I mean, it sounds like once the money came in, you basically had to take advantage of it.
Once the money came in, we did. But we had been talking about it at that point for about a year and a half. And all those conversations really were our preparation. Now, I had no time to rehearse with Luke Wilson, Elizabeth Moss, Giovanni Ribisi, all these incredible actors who came on board as our supporting cast. But everyone was
really
so
great
good.
Cast. You got Merritt Weaver in the
yes.
movie.
And there was more of Merritt Weaver that we couldn't fit in, but she was so brilliant.
And
gosh.
That girl who plays Alma is incredible.
Yes. It was a cast that was brought together to make a very intense story, all inspired by our director, Reed, and inspired, I think, by the passion that we arrived on set with. We were so grateful to be there every day, again, having scraped the money together, that everybody in the crew had this energy that was kind of ride or die. I mean, it was a small crew. When we shot, there's a scene in the beginning of the film where our son goes missing, and we were at a gas station in Nyack, New Jersey. And this is a testament to what a great neighborhood Nyack, New Jersey is, I suppose, because as Luke Wilson and I were running around screaming our son's name, Jesse, Jesse, we had, I think, three cars pull over and say, "What do you need? You need help? Who are you looking for?" And because we had such a tiny crew, they couldn't tell we were making a film. And I thought, well, I guess we're doing our jobs. But that's the kind of thing that does not happen, obviously, on a big set. You know, there'd be a huge crew. There'd be roadblocks. So, yeah, it was that kind of film.
It's funny because you were talking about that when we were talking about the physicality. I just remembering the only time we see Sarah relax is in the front seat of the car.
Mm-hmm. And I think when she smokes the DMT with Giovanni's character, and we see what is keeping her alive. We see her fantasy there.
Yeah, but that's almost like this kind of wish fulfillment. I mean,
right.
I think the only time we see her as her is, I mean, in that moment in the first 3 minutes or so,
yeah.
You guys are driving.
Yeah, and arguably the end is a moment of release, I like to think. It's such an intense film, and then I think we finally have this
moment. Something I've never had to ask anybody, a chance to ask anybody in the history of almost 20 years of doing this show.
Bring it on.
How did you get an elephant?
Well, that's a spoiler, but I want to tell
you. Well, I can say that because it won't, unless you see the movie, it won't mean anything to you.
That's true.
And this should be an enticement.
It could be a metaphor. They don't know.
In fact, as watching it, you wonder if it's a metaphor.
Exactly. My favorite thing in the world is after the movie when people ask me if the elephant was real. It just makes me so happy. But we did rent an elephant, and her name was Minnie. That's where the money went. No makeup, but we spent it on an elephant. It was tremendously difficult to convince our financiers to let us keep that elephant, but I threw my body on the tracks. I said, I forfeit every dime you could possibly give me. I want this elephant. And it was our saving grace. That elephant, to me, is the most important part of the film. And it was tricky. You know, that's when producing really, really becomes a fun challenge. We had to bring this elephant in from out of state. Her name's Minnie. She's the Laura Linney of elephants. She's incredible. She is an inspiration, and we had really good chemistry. The handler told us not to touch the elephant, and yet I touched
which
the elephant.
Which didn't seem to stop you.
I couldn't help it. She was too beautiful. And we brought her to the Bronx. Reed had this vision. She found a photo of a sort of surreal landscape when we were in prep and with elephants walking in the foreground. And I can't remember where this photo was actually taken. It was this industrial landscape and then these elephants. And she said, "This is what I want. This is what we need." And we found this little tiny grassy field in the Bronx with high rises behind it. And we made a ratty old circus tent and chained this elephant in front of it. And the image was so close to her reference photo that it was kind of shocking. It was as though she manifested this. She found the perfect place. This film felt like that in many ways. We dreamt of it so intensely that it actually somehow came to us. I think that takes a lot of like-minded, passionate people. But this elephant moment was so powerful that when we got to set that day and we turned the corner and saw Minnie, we both just burst into tears. We were so... It sort of represented the challenge of making this independent film and somehow how we had pulled it off.
By the way, we're not talking about a lost Beatles album. We're talking about an elephant. We're talking about the new film, Meadowland. Its star and producer, Olivia Wilde, is sitting across from me. It's The Treatment. Because that last section of the movie, and I don't want to say anything else to give anything away before that, it kind of almost becomes like a Polanski movie or like Knife on the Water or something. We're not sure how aware Sarah is of her descent or if she knows the effect. Because these the two kids that she connects with are the two kids who are the most damaged in ways that sort of remind her or make me think they represent two different sides of herself. Mm-hmm. Where the girl cuts herself and the boy just can't communicate with anybody and is given to tantrums and trying to live out these daydreams that he has. And they represent these two sort of poles of arrested development for her. Mm-hmm. And that last section of the movie is, for me, is where it becomes almost like a thriller, which really kind of terrifying, where he can't quite see what it is that she's trying to do, and she doesn't quite know what it is she wants to do, except she's looking for a kind of release and escape. That was really chilling stuff to see. Were you talking about taking this stuff home with you? I was really feeling it there.
Yeah, I found that having a child under my care while I, as the character, was spinning out of control was quite scary. You know, there's a thing that happens to you when you're a parent where you realize sometimes, oh my God, I'm the only person keeping this child alive. I am completely in control. I am bathing this child. I am holding this child. I'm protecting this child. In this moment, I'm the only thing between life and death. It's a thing that every parent recognizes, and I think it can send some people into panic attacks because you realize that responsibility. And as I was playing Sarah, I knew that I was spinning out with her, you know, in character, and that I had this child in my care. And I was quite literally driving the car that he was in. And, you know, we didn't have any fancy rigs pulling the car. I was just careening through New Jersey highways with this kid in the car.
So you were in live traffic.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We had a interaction with the police that was kind of intense, trying to explain to them we were making a movie. But it was so intense to realize it's a choice to take responsibility for another human being. It's a choice to be responsible enough to keep someone safe. And if you lose that instinct to make that choice, you are in a very different situation. You are potentially a threat to this innocent being. And that was chilling for me to play because my instincts are nurturing and to be maternal, particularly weeks after having a child. So it was very intense. And the actor, Ty Simpkins, who was playing that boy, Adam, had not read the entire script. His mother had protected him from it because it was so intense. So there were certain moments that he was a little bit nervous about and a little because he was unfamiliar with. For instance, there's a scene where I finally get a phone call that is resolution for this mystery, and I have a kind of meltdown on the side of a road. Ty did not know this was going to happen. The scene is I get out of the car, I have this pretty intense meltdown, and I get back in the car. And after the first take, there was this moment of silence after I got back in the car and I was breathing heavily, and he just said, that was weird. I was like, yeah, Ty, you know, emotions are weird, you know, like pain is weird, right? It's just weird, right? And he was like, yep. And this poor kid had just come from shooting Jurassic World with Chris Pratt, and all he had was
and this is more
fun.
Terrifying than being chased down by velociraptors.
He had just had like the most fun time of his life with a Chris Pratt's just like doing playing jokes all day. There's just food trucks everywhere. And then he comes to Meadowland where we're like, hi, get in the car. Get in the car. It was intense for him. What a trooper.
And just hearing that concern from you just makes me just think of what a dynamite mom you are. Oh. Well, I guess, though, for me, that section is really about who and what she is. And the real question becomes, is she going to pull out of this
yeah.
tailspin?
Yeah.
Which is kind of the underlying thing anyway. At what point is she going to? And then you just wonder, especially after this happens, is she going to?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess this goes back to me asking you what it was about the material that you liked. And I wonder if that was part of it too, because in Drinking Buddies, she's somebody who wants to be liked, mm-hmm. finally. I mean, mm-hmm. that's the difference. She wants to be part of this world, but this emotional catastrophe has just kind of knocked her off her feet. And it really is a case of trying to watch somebody try to stand up again.
Mm-hmm.
This is somebody who's chosen to distance herself from everything. So even though
I'm comparing
them.
Without an instinct to want to be liked. Yes, Sarah is...
But that for me is the crucial difference between the two.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's that dangerous place we were talking about where you lose that instinct for self-preservation. It's sort of in the same tailspin as losing the instinct to fit into society. You know, we're all being pretty obedient. We've accepted the rules of this society, and except for a certain number of people, a certain group, we have decided to play by these rules, stay in our lanes in traffic. And, you know, sometimes it just becomes very clear to me when I look around. I'm like, wow, we're all accepting this system and we're going along with it because we know it's what moves us forward. We know it works. We know this is how populations stay in existence. And yet, what happens when you fall out of that rhythm, when you fall out of line, when you swerve out of that lane in traffic? I think grief and pain is what propels that for people. I think that trauma stops you from understanding why you're playing by those rules. And so I think Sarah has reached that point where she sees no place for her in this world. And that's obviously a very dangerous place. And so that's when people can become very violent or self-destructive. And I think that's what worried me when reading the script. I thought, oh my God, if she takes this out on the people around her, if she turns this into anger that it becomes violent and projects outward, I'm so scared of that. I feel that she has that ability. Now, I won't give away the answer. I won't say what happens there. But it actually caused me to empathize with people who do terrible things.
Yeah? Why was that?
Because I thought of that pain that propels that. I thought of the crushing misery that forces you to stop taking care of other people because you don't see your place within the system. And I thought, wow, people who reach that point are dealing with an amount of pain that's hard for most of us to understand. I don't claim to fully empathize or understand that instinct, but it made me a little more sensitive to it. I thought, well, it comes from a very deeply painful place. I don't know. And if that's something that storytelling can do to allow us to empathize with those who seem the most far gone and difficult to understand, then maybe that's part of the reason we do it.
We're out of time. I can't thank you enough for doing this, Olivia. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I'm so honored.
You have a low threshold for honor. My guest is Olivia Wilde, whose new film is actress and producer is Meadowland. Our recording engineer here at KCRW is Kat York, who also mixes the show. It's edited by Blake Veit, who's the associate producer. Elephants and Butters, nothing left to talk about. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. To catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.